episode of That's So Cincinnati. We have a jam-packed show for you today. I'm here with my co-host, Burl Love. Hi, Burl.
Hi, Sherry. How you doing?
I'm good. We're going on the road today.
Phil, producer Phil, you got the Cincinnati Enquirer remote van all packed up with the satellite dish and, oh, we don't need that stuff anymore. We have the intranet. But yeah, we're going on the road. Where are we going, Sherry?
We are going to go to Butler County and visit Sheriff Richard Jones.
The Sheriff Richard T. Jones?
Absolutely. I feel like he needs no introduction, honestly, even like nationally. But, you know, he's been in the news. He was elected in 2004, and he has never made any bones about how he feels about undocumented people living in his community. And it's at the forefront at the moment. Butler County signed an agreement with ICE to allow inmates into the Butler County Jail. And I thought we would just hear directly from him on that.
Well, that's a good plan.
And he invited us to come see him instead of coming here, and I readily accepted.
I think that's great. You know, we have been reporting a lot since the Trump administration has put in its plans for federal budget cuts through the infamous DOGE committee. We've had a lot of stories on that. We've had stories about people protesting said cuts in front of the Tesla dealership, of course, because of Elon Musk. There have been people protesting and demonstrating on behalf of immigration. And I think that's where Sheriff Jones fits into this equation, because like you said, he has made it clear that he wants his county, his law enforcement officers to be assisting ICE, Immigration, Customs and Enforcement agents in getting, detaining those who are arrested while they determine whether they're going to be deported, whether they need to go to court. And so that's how he's involved, and that's why the Butler County Jail is involved. So off we go.
Off we go.
But before that, as we record, it's been a busy news day. The big headline is, and this doesn't happen every day, a CEO from one of our Fortune 500s is no longer CEO of said Fortune 500, and we're talking about Kroger.
Kroger's CEO, Rodney McMullen, he resigned following, and we're just going to take the quote right here, a board investigation of his personal conduct, unquote. And for anyone who's asked me and everyone who's texted, we don't know why.
Well, the release from Kroger made it clear, or they tried to make it clear, that his departure has nothing to do with, you know, the behavior has nothing to do with the business, you know, anything to do with earnings, anything to do with his role as CEO, that these are more of a personal nature, but they are not in line with the Kroger company's
ethics policy.
So one shoe has dropped, a big shoe, but the other shoe still has to be, you know, has to drop, and we have to figure out what's going on.
So
your significant other, Alex, is our lead reporter on this story. He's been working on it all day.
Poor Alex. Jack had to go to school. The dog was barking. I am like, I am putting on my makeup. I have to go into work. And he is like, I'm going to need you to do everything. So it was a little bit of chaotic. It happened early this morning.
So lots to report, lots of reaction yet to be had. They do have an interim CEO. So it should be business as usual. But anytime a shakeup like this happens that's unexpected, I think it's reasonable for people who watch the business scene in Cincinnati, who care about the health and well-being of our Fortune 500 companies, everything from their performance, where the stock is. There's a lot of local people who have Kroger stock. And what does that mean for the future of the company? And it's being headquartered here. I mean, this is not...
Those questions abound.
This is not a run-of-the-mill changing of the guard at Kroger, to put it...
And so there is a lot more to figure out about everything, but this was a huge stunner. Their timing is interesting. Their earnings call is Thursday, so that'd be March 7th, I believe. So they did that ahead of that call. So maybe some things will come out there.
And we're still in the wake of the merger that wasn't with Albertsons and the settlement. You know, Albertsons sued Kroger because of, well, you can read all the stories
that's
in the
right.
Inquirer.
I would rather.
But anytime a deal, anytime a merger deal like that goes south, you know, Albertsons made made it known that they thought it was mishandled by Kroger, and they went after some compensation, and they received a settlement. So, you know, there's just been a lot going on with Kroger here. So, more to come. But meanwhile, shall we hit the road and head north to Butler County?
Absolutely.
All right.
Special guest time here on That's So Cincinnati, remote edition. I'm very excited to welcome our guest, Sheriff Richard Jones. And today we're not in our podcast studio. We are here as his guests in the Butler County Jail. Thank you for having us.
Yes, ma'am. When you said your podcast,
yes,
and you're actually in a pod.
Describe where we are right now.
You're basically in what's referred to as the Butler County Jail. It's divided up. This is like a telephone pole style institution. This is what it's referred to. If you've got an aerial shot of it, it looked like telephone poles lined up across each other, pods on either side. Different pods hold different amount of inmates. You're looking here. These are two-person cells here, two men cells. They got bunks. They got a spot for a television. They got a cabinet, and they got a restroom. They've got showers. They've got a recreation area over here on the one side, and they eat their meals here. The meals are brought to them, and they've got phones where they can call their family. Then they've got a place here if they want to make a private call. It's they can close the door on that, and it's like a telephone booth that most of your viewers don't know what a telephone booth is. A telephone booth is a place where you used to have to put a quarter in and make a phone
Burl
call
and, I
and
know.
Close the
That's
door.
That's right.
That's so, how our parents picked us up from
now,
the movies.
Now, I have to describe the restroom. It's a sink-toilet combination in the corner of the cell.
Yes.
Okay.
And it's chrome. It's stainless steel. Now somebody might asking about this because we're not doing a video, but when someone has to use the restroom, where does the other person in the cell go? They're in there with them, unless the door is open and they're out in what we call the common area here. So you lose some privacy for sure. And when you shower, there are up to, I think, four people in the shower where the showers are. They have dividers, and you can see at the bottom, they're open. And that's so we can see the feet, mm-hmm. who's in there and where they're at in the showers.
I mean, basically, you're describing a high school locker room until about 1995 or so, because
yes. Yeah. And anybody's been in the military,
or if you played varsity
Boy
sports,
Scouts,
you gave up some privacy.
You gave
right?
up some privacy.
Yeah, the why?
Hey, grade school, we were made to take showers. Didn't like it much, but they made us take showers in grade school. This is what that is. But I tell people, this isn't like camp, going to camp and having fun. Your meals here come, they're prepared and signed off on by a dietitian. But I promise you, they don't taste like your grandma's or your mom or your aunt.
Hopefully
Millie.
Not.
They do not. But you get three hots and a place to sleep, and you get televisions. People may ask, why do they have televisions in their cells? It's the best babysitter in the world.
As most parents
keeps
know.
Keeps them in front of the TV where they're not fighting with other prisoners. Remember, no one wants to be here. But this place was built 20 years ago.
So it's painted bright blue. It's very light with fluorescent lights. And each pod holds 96 people.
For the most part, yes. Some more, not much more, some smaller. depending on what classification it is.
So we write about you all the time because you make a lot of news, but we came up to visit today because we're seeing what's happening in the news, and you signed an agreement with the federal government, with immigration.
Yes, ma'am.
To detain people who have been arrested by ICE.
Yes,
and we
ma'am.
Wanted to start a little bit about that and talk about what's going to be happening with that. And so this pod now is empty because it is awaiting people who will be arrested.
Yes, ma'am. They will come. ICE will either bring them here or we will go pick them up. In the agreement, we've agreed to transport for them. And we have the buses and the transportation to do that. Depends what they want. It's moving very fast. They'll come here. They'll go through our classification system, and then they will be escorted down the hallway that you came down. It's two long hallways. They'll walk single file on one side, like all the rest of our 800 prisoners. They'll come to these pods. They'll get an assignment. They'll get their gear. They'll get their blankets, pillows. They'll come here, get orientated to what the rules are, where they're at, the meal schedule. And there'll be an officer sitting up here on the deck, we call it, to where the officer or officers can oversee and open these doors electronically as the inmates come out for recreation, which is inside this area also. People from other countries, when we've done this in the past, they like soccer. So we have soccer balls in that area over. It's not a soccer field, but they like to play soccer. And when they're playing soccer, guess what? They're not fighting. And most of the time, when the people come and been incarcerated before in the past, the people that are from other countries, and when they're all in a single pod like these prisoners will be, my officers prefer to work these pods. They don't cause any problems. They'll play like checkers, chess, or they do dominoes. They talk to each other. They have a different color jumpsuit on so we can tell who they are. And they'll stay here unless they have a visit. The visits they do by, we have a place over here where they can do phone visits and they can call their family when they like. They have to call collect naturally. And if their lawyers come in, they have another place. They can go to this booth. The door's closed because we can't listen to their conversation. And the lawyers come in outside, and they can talk to their lawyers, usually with an interpreter.
So do you have a feel for how many people you might be holding here and how, what, geographically speaking, how big of an area? Is it all Southwest Ohio? Is it just Butler County?
I wish I could tell you. I don't know. The last time we had ICE here, which was 4 years ago, we had several hundred here. We had a contract with them. We had what's called 287G, which is the jail portion of that. And we had a 287G, which the federal government gives you where you can go out and assist ICE on task force and make arrest. And they came from all over the United States. Is this going to be local? Don't know. I would assume some of it, when you say local, Hamilton County, Montgomery County, the counties that surround us. We're close to Indiana. We're close to Kentucky. And in the past, we've even transported them to Michigan and picked them up. So I don't know. Will we get, there's other jails, but I wish I could tell you where they're coming from. But I can tell you ICE needs bed space. The last administration, they had 30,000 bed spaces they were allowed to have for the whole United States. The federal government doesn't have jails. They depend on sheriffs for jails. In Ohio, there's 88 counties, 88 sheriffs. Probably myself and one other sheriff's office will house inmates from ICE. Kentucky has one. Kentucky's a big place. Indiana, I don't know if they have any. Michigan, they may have some. 30,000 spread out throughout the United States.
Is
bed
this
space.
Going to be any different than they are being held in Kenton County by the U.S. Marshals Service at the moment? Will this be any different than that?
No, we have U.S. Marshal prisoners here. We have 180 U.S. Marshal prisoners here and have had for years. We had ICE prisoners here until the last administration came in.
And then did you have to stop doing things? Were there different directives then?
They kept changing things. They didn't want the inmates incarcerated, that administration, and they kept changing the rules. So I woke up one morning and said, this is a good day to fire them. So I came in and said, send them a notice that they can no longer stay here. And we fired them before they fired us.
So you mentioned that there are only two counties in Ohio.
That I know of.
That you know of.
That would be us and them.
Okay.
The other county.
Right.
That's the two.
Okay.
So really only one that I'm aware of.
But okay. One other one besides Butler County. Now, as sheriff, are you able to make that decision unilaterally? Did you need approval from, you know, the county leadership? We're sitting right here in the city of Hamilton.
Yeah. In Ohio, the sheriffs can't sign contracts. The commissioners can. In Ohio, there's three commissioners, except in Cuyahoga County, where they have charter form of government. Mm-hmm. I think they have 10. But every other county, which is 87, have three commissioners. Contracts have to be approved by the commissioners, the Butler County commissioners, just like they do. And then before that goes there, the prosecutor has to approve the contract language. So it went to the prosecutor, went to the commissioners, and today is Friday. So they signed off on it a few days ago. So it's in 5 days, it's went from the prosecutor to the commissioner, to the commissioners, to the marshals, from the marshals to ICE with all those signatures in less than 5 or 6 days.
They're moving very quickly with this administration.
But remember, the president wants it done quickly. And I can explain that later on. When I was just in D.C. 3 weeks ago, and the sheriffs were meeting with the Homeland Security guy, Holman. He met with the national sheriffs, and there was probably 200 of us in a room, and he spoke. And I can tell you it's moving. It's moving. I could get prisoners today. It's moving that fast. They don't have space, and their deportations are moving faster than they expected. And then there's self-deportation. They say it's moving. I don't understand how that works. I know the concept. And I get asked often, how do you self-deport? I always assume you just went to the border and went back. That's what I assume. I could be wrong.
I will say I have seen on the nightly news, Kristi Noem, the Homeland Security Director, has a very long commercial, and she is asking people to self-deport. And I did think, I'm not sure they're watching the nightly news, but it's a commercial. It is directed at that. She's asking people to leave. And she's like, please come here, like through the proper channels. And she's like, because if you're here illegally, you will not be allowed to stay. And she's like, it will be easier if you leave and try and use the proper channels.
If you get deported, what I've been told, it could take you up to 10 years to get back. That's what I've been told.
So you've been to the border.
I've been to the border 3 times. It's a mess. And I've been doing this with illegals into the country for 20 years here. I was one of the first ones that came out. And when I came out about the illegals here and the problem that it was causing, I was labeled as a racist, a bigot, homophobe, all the different phobes that they could throw at me. And the Republican Party, they stayed away from me. And when I was interviewed by the local paper, they used to do endorsements back then, and you would go through a screening. All the other office holders, their screening process was 10 minutes. Mine was 4 hours. I had to go out, use the restroom, get a drink, take my jacket off, and go back in. And they told me that I would lose votes, and people were scared to stand up. But
that was 2004, everyone?
Yes, and you think it was like, 100 years ago, but it was true. And the Republicans weren't any way in supporting this. They were all staying away from it.
What made you be on the forefront of that? Because sheriff is a political job. It is elected position. What made you say, I'm going to go against the Republican Party? I'm going to say
pretty
this
simple.
Is what I'm thinking. Why?
Pretty simple. Most politicians, it's hard for them to have backbones. Like a jellyfish doesn't have backbones. I have a backbone, and I listen to my constituents. I keep my ear to the ground. I don't listen to what other politicians say. I don't listen to what we call the courthouse crowd, which is the local politics. I get my information from the people that hired me, which are the citizens. Not everybody likes me, but I get my voice there. And they were getting concerned. But what really got me motivated to get behind this, we had a 9-year-old girl who was molested by an illegal not far from this jail from Mexico. He convinced her to go into an empty house. He molested her, then made her go home with no clothes on. She was just riding her bike. And then he fled to Mexico. Then it was very difficult to get him back, but we got him back. We got him back by offering rewards. And nobody wants a child molester. I don't care what country you're from. Nobody wants him.
What party you're from.
Place.
What party you're from.
Yeah. Hey, nobody wants a child molester in their neighborhood or at family reunions. They told on him and they got a reward for that. He came back, whined and cried in court. But before that, I got to looking at his file. Hell, he'd been deported several times and he was in and out of my jail, in and out. And at that time, ICE wasn't doing much. President Bush, I believe, was president at that time, and he was trying to support amnesty. And he was a Republican. But the people started turning. They didn't want that. And so that's what started my journey.
So let's go all the way back to the beginning of your journey.
Yes.
When did you know you wanted to go into law enforcement? You grew up around here, correct?
Yes. My father was a police officer. My whole family are cops. My mom worked at the juvenile center. My brothers, my sister, my son, my daughter's married to a cop. She was in law enforcement. So that was cop talk when I was growing up. I got up at 2 a.m. as a little kid. I was in the first grade. I can remember it like it was yesterday. The hair on my neck stands up telling you this story. And I got up. My dad was coming in the door. And he had blood on his white police shirt. And his car was parked out front. And I didn't know what to think. My dad was hurt. And he put his finger up to his lips and went, shh, don't wake your mom up. And he went into the restroom and cleaned the blood off of his face. And I was just mortified that my dad was hurt in his police uniform and the police car out front. And then he gave me a hug and gave me a kiss. And to this day, I can smell that aftershave, Menin aftershave. It's what I use. Sometimes smells affect you your whole life. But that's when I knew I was going to be a police officer. And when he came to my class in grade school, in first grade, he came to the door, and I was so proud. I looked up. There he was in his uniform. And he came in, talked to us, and they took all the kids out and let us listen to the police radio. And I recently went back to that school and went to that classroom. Wasn't any students in there. And they let me walk back in my uniform to that classroom, to the same door, and open that door and go in. I know that sounds kind of weird. And I parked where my father parked in his police car. And I made some calls on the radio like he did. And that was back in like 1960. So that's what motivated me to be a police officer. Long answer.
But what was the thought? The thought was you don't want him to get hurt. You don't want citizens to get hurt. Like what made you want to do it?
My thought was like boys mostly want to be like their father. I can't speak for ladies or girls, but most boys watch their father go to work. And when you're a little boy, you play different games, different things you do. And that's exciting. that your dad is a police officer. That's what motivated me. I wanted to be like my father and be a policeman. And I wish he could have lived long enough to see me become the sheriff. But he didn't. So, that's the motivation for me. And I've been doing this a long time.
You started out in corrections.
I started out in 1976 working in the prison system. And I could remember the first day I went there. And the inmates were going up and down the hallway. There was like 2,000 of them, 11 a correctional institution. And I was thinking, what the hell have I done? And they were all looking at me real hard. I knew as a new guy, I was 22 years old. And I went back and see my recruiter. I thought, I'll go back to the Army, because my dad never made a lot of money. We almost starved to death. So I stayed long enough that I went to school at night, got my associate's degree, got my bachelor's degree, got my master's degree from Xavier in corrections and criminal justice. I've taught classes in college. I became the major, lived on prison property, and then a sheriff got elected and he bought me over as number two guy, and the rest is history.
So at some point in every police officer, law enforcement officer's career, you have to make a decision. Do I want to take the fork in the road that takes me towards, you know, leadership? Or do I just want to be a beat cop? Or do I just want to do the work? Because it's very different, as you know. When did you decide, like, I need to run the place?
Well, when I started in the prison business, older men that had been there a long time, real tough men, they were my bosses. And I started taking classes at night, and they said, you're wasting your time. You'll never get anywhere with that stuff. That generation.
Mm-hmm.
And after I started taking all these classes, getting my education, and I was in a cell block in a hallway at Lebanon Correctional Institution, a high security prison, sweat running down the crack of my back. And I saw a guy go down the hall with a shirt and tie on. And he was a social worker, and he was going to his air-conditioned office. and I'm standing there going, what the hell? What's up with this? I got the same education as he has. I'm down here fighting and getting things thrown at you, and I'm thinking, why am I going to school? That guy's he gets holidays and weekends off, doesn't have to fight with people. That was what made me. I started testing, and I started getting jobs. And I started getting promoted. And that was one of the biggest giant motivating factors. It's a silly thing, but I could have still been there as a correction officer. But I wanted to make more money, which money isn't a bad thing. And in high school, I had a teacher tell me once that I could never be a cop because you won't go to college. And when I played sports, I maintained a C. You had to maintain a C average to play sports. I wasn't stupid. I wasn't dumb. I just maintained my C. And when you got out of high school, you married your high school sweetheart. You got a job in a factory around here. Or you went to the police department or wherever you could get a job. And that was it. Wasn't a lot of people went to college in my family. None. And that was motivating when she told me that. Now, people say teachers have, you know, they motivate you in a positive way, but sometimes they can motivate you in a negative way. I ended up having more college than she did, which I probably wasn't picked the most likely to succeed. But when I go to my high school reunion, I'm a pretty popular guy.
Where'd you go to high school?
Garfield High School in Hamilton, Ohio. And I played sports, and I was pretty good at it.
What were your sports?
Football and track. And you're thinking,
big guy
like me,
yeah.
What would track be?
Well, I mean, you need shot putters.
Put and yeah. and the coach wanted us big fat guys to be able to at least walk around the track when we were out there. So I lettered in two sports. But when I go to my high school reunion, I'm a pretty popular guy. Now, I wasn't voted the most likely to succeed. Just the opposite. But the ones that were most likely to succeed, nobody wants their pictures with them. So there I am. Now, I'm pretty proud of that. And I lived in a tough neighborhood. And here I am, the highest ranking law enforcement official in this county of 400,000, the seventh largest county in Ohio, and probably one of the most well-known sheriffs of over 3,300 in the United States. I've been to the border three times. I've been to the White House three times. I've been the opening act for President Trump at the U.S. Arena with 25,000 people there. And they wanted to know what my speech was. I said, I have no speech. They said, well, you have to have a written speech. I said, no, I don't. So they said, well, we'll find somebody else.
The president doesn't have a written speech usually.
No. He does. He just doesn't use it.
Listen, I gave a better speech than he did.
So that last bit of what you told us, there are about five or six follow-up questions just from that alone that I had in my notes. So, where to start? You talked about how you're very well known, not just in Ohio, but nationally.
Yes,
you
sir.
Have built this persona.
Yes.
You have been a outspoken supporter of President Trump. Have you talked with him since the inauguration?
No, I have not. He's a very busy man. I talked to him when he was running the first time, more than once. But it wasn't like a long conversation.
You don't have his cell phone?
No, I don't have his cell phone. He doesn't have mine. He's a very busy man, knows lots of people. But I've been supportive three of his campaigns.
Do you have any advice for him, having lived in this world that he cares so much about and understanding it? Do you have any advice for him?
Yeah. Surround yourself, which he has, with smart people. Listen to them. And, you know, he may only have 2 years to get this done because Congress and Senate could change. He has the majority. But he has smart people around him. He doesn't need much advice and he never sleeps. So just keep hiring and listening to smart people.
You told us before we started recording, you wake up at night and peek at what's happening
in my phone.
You see things?
I look up at get up at 3 a.m. and I look at my phone. I know he signed some executive orders. Hell, I wish I could sign executive orders. Things would be different for me too, but I can't.
So your national notoriety, let's say, and we talked about this before we started recording too, but if you're in the, you know, national network news business and you need to find a sheriff to speak about Ohio, they go to you and you have this persona. For those who can't picture you, you're on brand today. You're wearing your Stetson. I assume it's a Stetson because it's a sharp looking cowboy hat. You've got what I would describe as a Wyatt Earp mustache.
That's correct.
Is that fair?
That's fair.
It seems like you embrace that role. Like it's not by accident. Like you have crafted this image and it's working for you.
Yeah, it's my shtick.
Yeah.
When I walk in with my boots on, and I wear very expensive boots, nice boots, cowboy boots, and I wear different color hats. I have different, and I wear a wheel gun, which is a revolver. I'm different. And I do a cross draw.
Do you have it on now?
No, I do not, because you can't have a weapon on back here.
Oh. For your safety.
For everybody's safety. And I wear my weapon on the opposite side that most people. I do a cross draw. And somebody asked, why do you do that? I said, well, I'm different. And I am different. And I'm very sure of myself. I have lots of confidence. And when I walk in a room, I stand out. And people know who I am. And if you have any doubt where I stand on anything,
you're just not paying attention.
Yes, because I will give you my opinion and I don't try to convince you otherwise. For example, people that hate Trump, hey, good for them. I don't try to convince them otherwise because I can't. They can't convince me otherwise either. So this is me and I'm very boisterous. And I have opinions, and I'm not afraid to stand up and give you my opinion, and I don't apologize for any of it. Most of the time, I apologize before I speak to large crowds that I may offend some people in this room. Okay. And then I start. And I can speak okay, and I have fun with my job. I was going to run against John Boehner when he was Speaker of the House.
Taking me back.
I took petitions out, and the media, to include yours, the Inquirer, was, I mean, I was on the front page of every newspaper all over the United States. And then I chose not to. And somebody said, why? I said, I was afraid I'd get elected. And who the hell would want that job? That's what I was more afraid of.
You liked your current job.
I got the best job for a guy that grew up like me, poor, and in a poor neighborhood, and had there was five siblings in my family. We didn't always eat well, and we got like free memberships to the gym because we were poor, the neighborhood we lived in. But everybody in my neighborhood was poor, so I didn't know I was poor until I left that neighborhood when I grew up. And so, nope, I'm very sure of myself, and I'm not afraid. I've talked to the most powerful people in the world, and I talk to them, and I'm not afraid to do that.
So speaking of being outspoken, one of the recent stories we've written about you is about the sign that you put up outside.
Yes, sir.
I think it said illegal aliens here.
It
with an
did,
arrow.
With an arrow pointing to the jail. A big sign, big
and
yellow sign.
Not everybody was warming up to that. But you don't care about the blowback.
No, I don't care about the blowback at all.
What were you hoping to do with that sign? What was your goal?
I've had that sign up and down for 20 years. It's been on the front page of your newspaper.
Several times.
Front page.
I saw a spare in an office when we walked by.
I did too. I was
front page of your newspaper.
I was going to try
more
to steal
once.
That spare sign, but look, I can't steal anything in
that
jail.
Sign, that sign, you could, but you won't like it, I promise. But that sign has been up since 2004, up and down. The reason I first put it up was ICE was stating 20 years ago, there was no illegals around anywhere. They didn't know where any illegals were. So I had this giant sign made with an arrow pointing to the jail in case they couldn't find them. They're here in my jail. That's where they are.
He did hand us when we came in. There's some statistics here.
Yeah, so that's a great segue to what I wanted to ask. And you provided us ahead of time with some stats. You might need to look at them. I think, you know, I live in Hamilton County. I'm sure it's pretty similar in Butler County. I would say most residents don't wake up in the morning worried about what illegal immigration is doing to their daily lives. It's not a problem most people worry about or perceive, but you brought some numbers. Tell us in Butler County, how big is the problem?
Oh, it's huge. I use that word huge. You've heard that before, right?
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Huge. We won't say anything. But listen, in the past, under the Biden administration, in my jail on local charges, we call them state charges, in the past 4 years, I had a total of 1,450 inmates in my jail that have no Social Security number and from other countries. Now, where I went to school, that means they're probably not here legally, okay? And when you're born in this country, babies have Social Security numbers, okay? Of those 1,400, naturally, we notify ICE. People might think, well, what have they done? These are people from all over the world. They've committed roughly, those 1,450 prisoners have committed 2,000 crimes here. Some of them two and three crimes each. I want to repeat that. 2,000 crimes here in Butler County. So in 4 years. So if you think that it's not an issue, or if people think that, these are people that I'm going to go over some of the stats. Driving offenses, 482 for these 1,400 prisoners. Violations of court orders, almost 200. Crimes involving kids, 47. Cruelty to animals, 5. This is a big one here. Falsifying and obstructing, 265. Sex offenses, almost 100 sex offenses. Drug and alcohol offenses, 501. Violent offenses, 612. On and on and on. And these are the offenses that these people have committed in this county, and they were in my jail.
That ended up in your jail.
Ended up in my jail. So when people say we don't have people here that are illegal aliens, we do. They're here. Now, I can go on and on with instances where they've committed these crimes. And I had one guy in my jail that is probably still here, been deported 8 times, and comes back here, deported from this country 8 times, and finally killed somebody. And he was in my jail when they found out he killed somebody here. So, and probably killed others. Most of the time, these offenses are committed against their own people where they live in these communities. They're afraid to tell people. And I go out of my way to make sure people understand that we're all border states. There's two borders. Canada, which is the northern border, which has been wide open, fentanyl, drug trafficking, and people trafficking, kid trafficking. When they start working on sealing the border in the southern border, it's like a giant balloon effect. Then they come to the northern border, Canada, and they come through. We're on the highway where that takes place. And I could give you some other instances of some of these heinous crimes, but I don't think you have enough time for that.
So from your perspective, because when I'm watching the news about everything that's happening, they've been very vocal about what they're doing. They're deporting people who are in this country illegally. But isn't it better to prosecute them? Like if they've committed a crime, isn't it better to go through the U.S. justice system? Because I've wondered this, honestly. If we deport them, do they come back? Because I'm hearing you say that, and I have heard that many times. What is the better thing to do? Is it to deport them, or is it to use the justice system?
That's a good question. That's a good question. Our prisons are full already with homegrown criminals, okay? I don't know that we have enough room for these foreign-born people that are committing crimes here. Now, for murder, rape, they go to prison here. For these drunk driving charges, lying,
most drug charges.
Yeah, they can go back to the country once they came. And believe me, they won't want to go back. And some of these countries, their prisons and jails aren't like this, I promise you. They don't want to go back. They might pretend like they do. They do not want to go back. But if you work on, you have to seal the border at the same time you deport people back, or they just come running back and you look like fools. That's drying up, and you can't do it without the help of Mexico and Canada. That's changing somewhat. And the drug cartel basically runs Mexico, whether people believe it or not. I can tell you without a doubt, I'm on several of these national committees, that there's several drug cartels in Mexico and those other countries. They run the country. They run the police, they run the military, and they run the president of Mexico. I mean, it's just the way it is. And if you go against that, you'll be killed, your family will be killed. A very violent place to be. It's sad. It's not a poor country, but it's portrayed as it. They're a big oil producer and they're a coffee producer. But the money stays at the top. The drug cartel controls everything. You can't just walk across the border on your own. The drug cartel runs that business. If you're from another country and you want to come into the United States, you have to pay the drug cartel. Can be anywhere from $10,000 to $20,000, depending on where you're from. If you're from China, it costs more. They just don't walk across the border and have a little pack, and you'll be killed because the drug cartel will not allow that to happen.
So one of the points of debate with this whole immigration issue is, and let's just frame it in terms of the numbers that we went over in Butler County in this general area. So 1,450 people over the last 4 years here illegally that committed a crime. I have no idea what percentage that is of everybody that's here illegally undocumented, because there are people that are here because they're, you know, trying to find a better life. They're trying to escape, you know, whether they're, you know, the cartels in Mexico, and they get here and they join the workforce. And there have been people who are concerned about just this big sweep because, you know, whether it's farms or factories or even restaurants, this could have an adverse effect on the workforce, because in many instances, people who are new to this country are taking the jobs that, frankly, if you're born here and educated here, you don't want to do. So are we throwing the baby out with the bathwater, you think, with this current focus on deportations?
A very good question, but my answer is no. Americans don't do much roof work anymore because these people that come in from these other countries will work daylight till dark. They'll work with flashlights. They live five families to a house. They get drove to work. They have to pay whoever drives them to work. They have one person that speaks English. And the people that own these businesses, shame on them. This is not the American dream. They'll never be able to dig their way out of that, ever. The American dream is where you can get ahead in life. You can put a little, save a little money, send your kids to college. That's not the American dream. And you got to come here legally. We allow 2 million people a year to come here legally. Let me ask you this. Let's say you got a little house and a nice car. And you're in your living room watching TV. And a couple people just open the door and come on in and sit down in your house. They weren't invited, but they're poor and they need to come in your house and they just want to hang around and eat some of your groceries. You wouldn't like that. Nobody would. You can't just sneak into this country and start feeding and taking stuff away from Americans. Listen, people that pick fruit, work on the farms, we've always had that. They had work visas. They came here. They worked. They went back to the country where they came from. This isn't new. It isn't rocket science. But rich business people took advantage of that. And I know where there's factories in this county and surrounding counties and in the country where they bring them in and they work the hell out of them and they have no say-so. They pay them cheap wages, cheaper than what they pay Americans. And that's why they take advantage of them. And there are Americans that will put roofs on, but you got to pay them. And there's people that are working these factories, but you got to pay them. People that own these businesses would rather pay them cheaply. They'll even rent houses for them, put five families in there. That's not a way to really live. It's not the American dream. And I have compassion for them. But you can't just sneak into our country like sneaking into your house in the middle of the night. And you talked about earlier that people don't wake up and talk about immigration. I differ with you. That's mostly what I hear about when I go out. I'm out a lot of places. I know you are. Maybe it's just the county that I'm in. I don't care where I go. People talk about it. Now, not everybody likes the same stance as me, but it is the talk. And anytime you guys have news articles on, it gets more hits than any other article.
How do you know that? Are you peeking over my analytic reports?
Is it worse?
I know stuff. I promise you.
Is it worse here than other counties? And other counties are pretending it's not a problem?
No.
No, it's all the same.
You're in Sanctuary County and Hamilton County and the city. And I talked to the sheriff about it. Mm-hmm. Sheriff McGuffey. She's my friend. I like her. And the police chief. But they have... the police chief has a city manager. They have a safety director. They have a council. And they're all, they don't want them to cooperate with the police. And that's okay. Because I encourage people, if you're here illegally, go to Hamilton County or go to Montgomery County. They give you all the welfare you want. They'll give you free phones, free cars. They'll put you ahead of veterans. They'll put you in a place to live. And they'll spend a fortune on you. So there you go.
It's news to me that they're giving away free cars.
Now, I don't believe that.
You don't believe they're giving away free cars?
No, but let me explain this to you. You know what an NGO is?
Yeah.
It's a non-government
operation.
They've received billions, hundreds of millions of dollars throughout the United States. You've got a couple of those places in Hamilton County.
Story assignment coming.
Hey, listen, and I'm telling you, they help them get loans to buy equipment. They buy food trailers. They can't get food trailers, these big fancy food trailers, and they're not even here legally. You have to pay for those probably $100,000-$200,000. And
you're not talking about like food trucks?
Yes. Americans have old raggedy food trucks.
There are all kinds of services that they provide. And I'm sure Butler County provides similar services.
We do. And the same NGOs that you have, we have here. But their money's drying up. they're not going to get a lot of free stuff. They make a huge profit. They don't do it for free. They go to these countries and recruit. They give them money. They put them up in hotels. That's my opinion.
So
there you go.
What you said backs up something that we pay attention to when we're trying to report a story, and that's follow the money.
Yes.
The, you know, what you said earlier about, you know, the factory owners, the business owners.
Sure.
Cheap labor.
Right.
Now they've dug themselves in a hole because that's how they keep their business afloat, by not paying prevailing wages.
That is correct.
Yeah. So in many ways, we've inflicted this upon ourselves.
Yes, we have.
Do you think that's one of the reasons we seem to be not making much progress? I mean, we you know, depending on who's in the White House and what the administration's doing, we've had ups and downs. We've had, you know, like right now, very aggressive deportation policies, and we back it off because, you know, all these people that we elect have constituents that are worried about what happens if we don't have some form of immigration in the workforce. But yet we, you know, you talked about work visas.
Yeah.
We haven't had a successful, I would say, program in decades in terms of.
Well, are you considering 184 visas? Listen, that's how many visas there are in this country. 184 should only be five. The legal system is broken. We allow 2 million people to come in a year. It should be more. And we have almost 200 visas. That's too many. Nobody knows what they mean.
Which kind of gets to the question I was about to ask. With what you're doing now, preparing to, in this very pod we're sitting in, to
you're
preparing to hold ICE detainees prior to deportation or whatever their path is.
Yes, sir.
Do you feel like you're contributing at all to a greater solution, or is this just the latest Band-Aid?
I hope this will be a solution. Listening to Mr. Holman on TV, he's the border czar. Mm-hmm. He said they've said 15 million people. Last night he said could be 30 million people that are here illegally. They're talking about a registration system. I assume you guys have heard that, to where if you're here illegally, you have to register, fingerprint. I don't know where that is or how that's going to work. But he also said if you don't register, you will be arrested. So I don't know how that works. There's only so much bed space. And getting this many people back across that border, I promise you this, it won't be pretty. It's not a pretty, it's what I refer to in law enforcement as organized chaos. That's what we call that. Everything that can go wrong will. And it's just, he's been president 40 days.
I know.
It's like he's been
longer.
There. Look, seems like he's been there 5 years.
Did you go to the inauguration?
No, I was offered to go to that. I'd rather have a cheeseburger. Look, I went to the convention, and once I got there, I went, what the hell have I done? I had to wait in line for an hour. It took an hour. It was 8 in the morning till 2 in the morning.
Conventions are chaos.
Yeah, but it was exciting and fun, but I wouldn't go to that inaugural. I know people that have, but I didn't want that. But I can tell you right now, this is, it's only been 40 days. And I forget how many people he said they've deported already, counting self-deportation, but only 40 days. These countries now are sending their jets to pick them up. And in the beginning, they said they wouldn't take anybody back, but they are. Mexico said they wouldn't help with the border. They are. Canada said they wouldn't help with the border. They are. 40 days. We haven't seen nothing yet. And am I doing any good by having these people here in, with deportation? I feel I am. You have to send a message. You can't just come here. No country allows everybody to come in, the good and the bad. And the gotaways, who knows who they are and what they've... I've been to the border 3 times. I've seen it. I'm on the national border committees. I've talked myself to death with this. Just in 5 days, I've done 5 interviews. Or in 2 days, I've done 5 interviews back to back on this issue.
His favorite is ours, though.
Yes. And I'm saving you guys last for the best.
Oh, well.
I do have a question for you.
And this should be the last, because we are...
It's a good last question.
At time. All right.
You did say you love your job.
Yes, I do.
And you have spoken on this issue for a long time, and I feel like you have a good handle on everything, and you certainly do share the administration's perspective.
Yes, ma'am.
The top two people at ICE were let go. They are not moving quick enough for the president's his taste. Do you want one of those jobs? Would you take one of those jobs?
No, I wouldn't want to work for the president because I like to take naps and he doesn't sleep. And listen, I just met those two guys at when I was in D.C. 3 weeks ago. I just met them and they came from other places and they replaced somebody. Mm-hmm. I knew those guys too because they were there too, but they were working for these companies and now different companies. And that doesn't surprise me. He's sending a message that you either get on board, you can have these jobs, but you better be willing to work 16, 20 hours a day, and you better produce. What we've had in the past, all presidents come in, they give all these orders and change everything, and nobody follows up with it. This guy follows up with it. And I just met those two guys that you're talking about 3 weeks ago. They gave us all a talk. And I leaned over to the guy that was with me. I said, they won't last. Because when Homan was done talking, then these guys got up and talked the next day. They weren't on the same page. Mr. Homan said, you'll go to the classes that you have to go to 4 weeks are going to be 1 week. And then the next day when we talked to these guys, they said, I don't think we can do it in a week. Well, those guys are gone. That doesn't surprise me. No. Is that a good answer? It doesn't surprise me. But I knew the guys.
The best answers are honest answers.
It is. And there'll probably be other people. Hey, the art of firing people. And he doesn't have but 4 years, really maybe 2 years. They're hoping that we'll have control of the House and the Senate, but they may not. Traditionally, that doesn't happen, but the whole world's kind of different now. That there'll probably be others fired. Like I say, working for him, you better bring a sandwich to work with you. You won't have time to go out and eat anywhere.
Well, I would hazard a guess to say that you probably keep a busy schedule as well.
I do. And
maybe not that busy.
But no, but I like my job. It's a dream of mine when I was a kid and to be a law enforcement, but to be the sheriff where I live and to be the longest serving sheriff in this county, 6 terms. I've been sheriff elected 22 years. I talk to young men that they only know me as the sheriff. There's no age limits or term limits. I stay in good health. And my wife doesn't want me home. So I have to work. You understand?
I do understand. Well, thank you for having us as your guest in the jail here. It's been a while since I've been in jail. hopefully that's knock on wood or aluminum here or steel. But thank you for your time. Thank
yes,
you
sir.
For your candor,
yes, sir.
Which we expected, of course. That's
yes, sir.
You're known for that. And we hope to check back in with you.
This week
to see how things are going.
Yes,
listen, you're more than welcome. You ask hard questions, tough questions, and as I told you, I've been asked these questions and more. There's none I haven't been asked, I promise you. And as far as somebody that knows about immigration, I consider myself somewhat of an expert in this area and in this endeavor that we're doing right now.
And on that, we thank you, Sheriff Jones.
Thank both of you for having me.
All right. So we took the podcast on the road, Burl.
That was fun. I can't tell you that on my bingo card, I did not have recording the podcast in the jail. But we've had other big news this week, Sherry.
A lot of big news.
And it's probably not what you're thinking about. But as reported in the Enquirer today, as we record, Bill Cunningham is still alive.
Is that a sentence I thought I would be staying in 2025?
Also did not have that on my bingo card. So we have the great American with us to close out the podcast. Bill, I've always wanted to say this. Bill Cunningham, give us a full report.
I'm sitting there quietly doing my duty to the American people. And if you've been in the studio, the telepad is about 2 feet away from when I'm on the air to take calls. I hit a call. And for some reason, it was 4 feet away. And I was sitting there at my duty post, entertaining and informing the American people. And first caller was Mark from Missouri, who's a, I put him on about once or twice a month. He's kind of funny. He makes more sense than many. And so I'm reaching to pull the telepad closer to me so I can hit the magical button. And as I hit the magical button, I'm kind of half standing up, leaning over the desk where I broadcast from. And I had to keep my head kind of at the microphone, so I was stretching to pull. I got the telepad. Mark from Missouri. And just as I did that, I sat back down. But the chair, unbeknownst to me, had moved about 2 feet backwards. So as I sat down, my generous buttocks hit the floor at a high rate of speed. And my head snapped back and hit the wall behind me, and I was stunned. And well, at that moment, my producer, who is not in the same area as I'm in, thought I died of a heart attack because he heard me tumbling and falling. So he comes running around, are you okay? Went to a break. And so that's half the story. The other half is Scott Sloan decided to make a bit out of it to report to the nation that I died of a heart attack. And he played the sound, played some dirge music, and also some other appropriate tunes, Amazing Grace, How Sweet the Sound That Saved a Wretch Like Me. And he announced that I was dead.
As all best friends kind of do, co-workers, friends. You can't make light of it, though, when you're on the radio. My phone went bonkers. I was in the middle of something, and people are like, did Bill Cunningham die? And I'm like, I don't think so. Scared the heck out of me.
I tell you, the good part is about 11 a.m., I get a call from Governor Mike DeWine. and he's coming out of a meeting in Youngstown on something to do with that terrible train derailment, an update. And he says to me, are you okay? And I said, I think I am. He said, are you dead? I said, I don't think I am. I said, on second thought, yes, I'm dead. I'm now a bot, and this is AI generated. He said, oh, no. He says, I'm going to take the state flags at half staff for 3 days. I said, no, I'm not dead. It's a Scott Sloan bit that isn't working because I've gotten over 100 messages from people, and my wife got calls from her family. And this thing circulated the globe before Truth could take its first step.
Well, that's why we're here, Bill. As usual, the Enquirer came in and did some fact checking, found out that, like Mark Twain, reports of your death have been greatly exaggerated. I know I'm butchering that quote, but so.
Well, I tell you what it showed me is that there might be some people that actually care that I was alive. It gave me
it's like a glimpse into what it could be like. But I have to tell you, and the next time I talk to the governor, I will have to mention 3 days. Try 30. What would we do without you?
I told Mike I would not be in a government that would have me as a representative. So the odds of that happening are quite small. But nonetheless, I kind of laughed, and it was kind of a bit thing. I guess it kind of worked or didn't work, but every now and then you have to have some credibility in the media, and the reports of my demise are grossly exaggerated. I'm still alive. My so-called boss came in, DJ Hodge, and he said, are you okay? And I said, why? He said, I heard you were dead. I read it in the Enquirer. I said, no. It said, I'm not dead. He said, well, how do they report things that didn't happen? I said, well, it was a good thing. It was a slow news day. That's all I can think about.
It was not a slow news day.
It was a little bit. Well, yes. I mean, it's not every day you have the CEO of a Fortune 500 company be dismissed. But your story, the Bill Cunningham is alive story was a close second. So,
well, Rodney Cullen, I mean, that's a big deal because I like to think Kroger has that superstore on Central Parkway because of Rodney. I like to think Kroger headquarters are here maybe because of Rodney. And I hope it doesn't have a big negative effect on Kroger because that's a.
That's it. We're starting a whole new podcast. All right. So I'll count us in. Oh, no. Sorry.
That's a different one. But I guess me and Rodney are. I guess one is fired, the other one's still alive. And I hope, I'm sad that one happened. I'm glad the other one worked out well, too.
It's a Monday.
So, Bill, all kidding aside, there was a little bit of a, you know, for your listeners, and you're on Sunday nights, you're syndicated across the country. There was a moment where people thought, if they were listening live, they could have assumed the worst. Now, you said you fell back. Were you injured, Bill? Are you nursing? No. Are you nursing any wounds right now?
No, no. In the back of my head, I can see where it hit the wall. But in radio, we have about a half an inch thick wall that's a little bit soft.
The soundproofing.
Are you saying your head is harder than that wall?
Yes. If it was a real wall, I might have had trouble. But it was like a beauty rest mattress, and about a half an inch of flex. So my pelvis is fine. My hips are fine. I'm fine. It could have happened to anyone. I've never fallen out of my chair like that. And it was because things were out of whack. And I assumed a chair was behind me when I sat down. And there wasn't a chair behind me when I sat down. And I was occupied taking calls from Missouri.
We are very glad you're okay.
Bill.
Me too.
Yes, we're glad you're okay. We're glad you could join us at the end of this podcast here.
Great.
So that our listeners could hear firsthand that you are indeed not unalive, if that
now,
makes
lastly,
sense.
Lastly, I just saw on my MasterCard, $14.95 a month, my Inquirer, and I'm going to keep it. I love going online. Whatever I am in the world, I'll check out the Inquirer. My $14.95 a month is well spent.
It's a bargain. I mean,
thank you very much.
That's barely three cups of coffee at Starbucks, and you get the world at your fingertips.
It's two cups. What are you talking about?
Well, you must get those fancy drinks like sherry. I can't even string all those words
Alex
together.
Alex makes me drink Keurig K cups at home. Like, what? I'm a one cup of coffee girl. I almost never go out and get coffee.
It goes a while, but I tell you what, it was 14. Wherever I am in the world, I always check Inquirer.com, Cincinnati.com to see what's going on.
All right.
But I keep my subscription for quite a while.
Well, thank you, Bill. We appreciate you joining us, and we are very glad you're okay.
God bless America. Let's go Kroger-ing.
All right. Thanks a lot, Bill. Bye-bye now. Well, Sherry, I don't think there's anything else to say. Should we wrap this podcast up?
It was really good to hear his voice. We texted earlier today, but you know, you don't ever want to hear that. That was kind of scary. Like in the job that we have, sometimes you do hear terrible news. So this was a good way to end the day.
Well,
a little with a Bill Cunningham laugh.
And his counterpart, who is on the air before him every day, Scott Sloan, once it was established Bill was indeed alive, it was pretty funny. The tributes, the music.
Uh-huh.
He played it deadpan. I mean, no pun intended. Now made for some good radio. Never a dull moment here, Sherry.
Newsrooms know how to have fun.
Thanks for listening to this week's episode of the That's So Cincinnati podcast, a production of The Enquirer and Cincinnati.com. Is something wrong, she said? Well, of course there is. You're still alive, she said. Oh, and do I deserve to be?
If you enjoyed the podcast, please give us a rating and share it with a friend who loves all things Cincinnati.
Finally, if you value local journalism, and I know you do, and haven't subscribed, like Bill Cunningham, for full digital access to Cincinnati.com, now is a great time. Just go to Cincinnati.com and click on the subscribe button to see a special offer just for you. Is that the question? And if so, who answers?
Thanks again. See you next week.